Hello, and welcome to the Wokus Roundtable Podcast. Today we are talking about poetry. Today we are talking with F.J. Bergman, who is, I believe, the editor of Starline magazine?
That's correct.
And also with Mike Allen. Say hello.
Hello.
So this all got kicked off, as it were, when on the Wokus Roundtable... One of the Locust Roundtable, how do you say, discussion lists, we started talking about poetry. We were asking some of the authors what poetry they found, and I'll quote here, useful and or inspirational. And FJ, I believe you took me to task a bit for that phraseology, and for which I admit was at the very best awkward.
I think the poets, like science fiction and fantasy writers, are in the entertainment business, as Kurt Vonnegut put it when he taught in an MFA program. And I don't like the idea of having to be useful in any way in my poetry, other than as entertainment, of course. And inspirational is one of those horrible words, like motivational, that tends to produce absolutely repulsive poetry.
Well, to be fair, I think that in the context that you brought that up, I guess you were asking those authors what poetry that they felt had perhaps been useful or inspirational to them.
Right.
And so I can understand that in this case, but you know, it's also true that if you were to ask me, are there any poems that I have written that are inspirational or useful? I imagine probably the opposite is true. Some of my stuff goes in pretty dark places indeed. And even the funny stuff can be a bit biting. Whether it's been inspirational to someone else down the road, I don't know. Maybe someday they'll tell me. but I am at least having fun doing what I'm doing most of the time.
And then the other thing that occurred during that conversation was that a lot of the authors took the question sort of the way I meant it, which was what I really should have said was, what's your favorite poetry? But even then, FJ, there were some, you were not happy with the way that took a turn.
I was disappointed that none of them seemed to have any awareness that science fiction, that speculative poetry existed. And given that they were all writers in the speculative genre, that seemed very sad.
I think that speculative poetry and those of us who write it, we have a bit of a tough row to hoe in that, although science fiction and fantasy in general have definitely entered the mainstream, and in fact you could argue that they dominate pop culture. Those of us who write poetry that riffs on those themes, we are not pop culture giants. You know, we do not have a Stephen King out there or a George Lucas or I'm not even pulling from the poetry side of things, because I don't think. In today's society, poetry has people who are considered of that stature in pop culture. Certainly, you know, there are people like Billy Collins who have achieved quite a lot in the poetry world, have been the poet laureate, been ambassadors for poets in general. But we don't really have an equivalent of that. Now, I don't feel like I need to defend what I do. I mean, to some degree, if you're a writer, you don't have a lot of control over the muse. and if the muse wants you to write poetry, you write poetry. But I think that some of the things that come out of our corner are definitely worthy of note. I think the best speculative poetry has to offer stand toe-to-toe with the best speculative fiction offers. In fact, you could argue that speculative poetry is in some ways just another variant of speculative fiction and functions that way. And so, you know, it's nice to have a little recognition every once in a while. And by the way, I want to say, Karen, thank you very much for doing this, letting us have the pedestal for a little bit.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I really enjoy talking about poetry like this. Poetry does something quite different from fiction. It's like a little pocket universe, and it can function very quickly on multiple levels, where I think a fiction may work on many levels, but it on more than one level, but it's so much slower to build. Whereas poetry can create a very intense thought process very quickly. And I like what it does when it uses the speculative tropes.
I think that there are ways, and this might surprise people, because I think a lot of people think of poetry as, well, you know, sonnet. You have a specific rhyme scheme and, 14 lines and all that. But of course, you know, there's all the range of free verse and all the different forms. And there's a way in which working in poetry is very liberating, because there are things that you can just not worry about when you want to present an idea. You know, obviously there's a lot of expectations that come with fiction, where, you know, you're going to go into all this great detail, building your world so that, you know, the 100,000 fans who read your novel and read more into it than you ever intended when you write it will be analyzing, you know, this world for years and years and years later, you know, trying to decipher every little detail, biology of every little creature. Well, you don't need to worry about that sort of thing so much in poetry. You can just kind of use what you absolutely need and get right to the point. I feel like I ought to toss out an example or two. I'm going to start with somebody who I think, in my opinion, is probably the best genre poet writing right now, and that would be Catherine Valenti.
True, yep. Or rather, I'm not sure I can endorse that and say true for all everything, but I certainly do love what she writes.
Right. And, you know, I published a... I'll be selfish, and I will cite a poem that I published by her in a short-lived anthology series that I did called Mythic. It's called The Eight Legs of Grandmother Spider. And it alternates... This may set off an interesting discussion between me and Jeannie. Let's see. It alternates between a recounting of the Native American fable of Grandmother Spider and a personal memoir of Cat's own grandmother. And the juxtaposition of the two and the way she ultimately ties them together in the end are very powerful. And the poem, you know, the poem is very deeply personal, very emotional, but yet, because of her introduction of mythology, also gives you this otherworldly feel that you would not necessarily get in your typical confessional poem. And I think it's much better for having taken that approach. Another example, this one is perhaps a little bit more obviously straightforward speculative. There's a Los Angeles poet named W. Gregory Stewart, wrote a wonderful poem that was published in the 1990s called The Button and What You Know. It was actually published in Amazing Stories, and they presented it as a short story, and it was a Nebula finalist. But, you know, when you look at it, you can see it is a poem, and it's this very playful poem that imagines a narrator suddenly confronted with a button floating in the air, and the narrator is given this choice to press the button, and the poem then just has all kinds of fun just imagining what the consequences will be if the narrator presses this button. You know, will it you know, cause an alien world to be destroyed, and in, you know, in some other region of the galaxy, you know, will it end life on Earth? What will it do? I definitely would recommend seeking that poem out. I think you can find it illegally posted online. you know, as an example of how this form can function. But I mean, that's two examples just off the top of my head, and I have more. What I want to toss out, having said that, is there's a kind of generally accepted definition of what speculative poetry is, but there's no hard and fast boundary, so it can actually go, can end up doing a whole lot of different things. But I should probably let Jeannie talk. the reason why I said this might cause an interesting debate between me and Jeannie is because I wonder, Jeannie, if what I described in Cat Valenti's poem strikes you as a speculative poem.
Well, I have to say that I find it disappointing when the genre elements are used only metaphorically rather than literally. I think maybe this is where we start to enter the definition of speculative poetry. Karen referred to it at one point as spec-fic poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually an important distinction, that of course we have the problem with the word speculative taken literally, not meaning quite the same thing as speculative as applied to genre. But I think we can't really have speculative poetry without the narrative element, that merely referring to a spaceship or a Shuggoth won't do it. That we need to have some kind of narrative going on, even if something or several other things are taking place at other levels within the poem. You can't say, you know, when she turned her face, she looked almost like an alien, or she appeared to be an alien. She turned her face into the moon, and I saw that beneath her skin was the alien presence I had always known was there. Then we have something that does enter the speculative realm.
Right.
So I think that while we don't call it speculative fiction poetry, we do call it science fiction poetry, and that the fictional aspect, the story, the narrative, is an integral part of that kind of poetry.
You might be amused to know that there have been raging arguments over, you know, whether this kind of poetry should be called science fiction poetry or speculative poetry. I guess in the larger field, you have the argument over, you know, which is better and more appropriate, science fiction and fantasy or speculative or what have you. You know, that happened.
And God save us all if anyone says sci-fi.
Right.
the marketing is where it breaks down. I like the idea of speculative being more correct and all-encompassing, but I work in a used bookstore. No one has ever come to this bookstore and asked for speculative anything.
Right.
Most people ask for science fiction, and very rarely do they ask for fantasy. They'll come in and say, where's your science fiction, like Game of Thrones? And I think that it would be better to stick with what the general public is familiar with rather than trying to change what they're calling something that they don't even know exists. And by that I mean the poetry part,
right,
of the speculative field.
Yeah, I guess I have I don't know. I'm okay with, I'm somebody who calls it both. Science fiction poetry is an awkward kind of mouthful. but on the other hand, speculative poetry, you say that people don't know what you're talking about. So I mean, this is the sort of problem we have to deal with this in this corner. Now, I'm not going to rebut Jeannie. I'm just going to give my personal perspective. Perspective. I'm going to pronounce words properly too. I guess when I started getting involved in this sort of poetry as an editor, I edit a publication called Mythic Delirium. It's a tiny little do-it-yourself zine. You know, I feel like these days I'm somebody who's sort of left over from the Triassic period, because nowadays people don't do print zines anymore unless you're somebody who's been around a while. Now it's all websites. But Mythic Delirium has been around since 1998. It is still coming out. I just put a new issue out, actually. Has some new poetry from Amal El-Motar in there. Amal is an example of kind of a newer generation of speculative poets. She's won the Riesling Award twice. But you know, she's also been a finalist for the Nebula Award, so it's definitely a pleasure to have her in these pages. She does a lot of myth-based poetry. But to get back to my original point, when I first started doing Mythic Delirium, I had a very kind of rigid definition in my mind of what speculative poetry should be. You know, it should be something that I absolutely recognize as being about a world that is not ours. Whether it's a version of Earth in which magic is possible, or some science fiction future, some other planet, some neverwhere, whatever. And I guess about 2005, I became involved with the publication, involved might be too strong a term, but I became connected through friends with a relatively new publication called Jabberwocky. It was started by Prime Books. It's still going on, run by Erzabit Carr, who does Papaveria Press. I believe Sean Walls is still involved in it. And I created my own sort of version of Jabberwocky, which were the mythic anthologies. And with those anthologies, I kind of deliberately relaxed that stricture and started judging more on whether or not a poem felt otherworldly to me than whether it was actually definitively otherworldly. And I have been going by that subjective standard ever since. That, I guess, maybe helps to further muddy the waters as to what speculative poetry is. However, those waters have always been kind of muddy. And, you know, if you want hard evidence of that, all you would need to do is look at the poems that have won the Science Fiction Poetry Association's Riesling Award since it was founded back in 1978, and then go actually read them, because you'll see that what you find in there is all over the map. There are, there is stuff that is pretty obvious, straightforward sci-fi. There's stuff that's very surreal. There's stuff that really qualifies more as metaphor or memoir. One of my absolute favorite poems that has won a Rising Award is by Joe Haldeman. I do not know how many people out there know that Joe Haldeman is an amazing poet, but he is. And, you know, I certainly hope people who are fans of his work will pursue that side, because he's written some amazing stuff. And one of these amazing poems is called January Fires. And it is a memoir written after he witnessed one of the shuttle explosions. I guess it was the Challenger. He was actually an eyewitness to that. And it's called January Fires because he also refers to the three astronauts who were killed on the launch pad. And I'm afraid my memory is going to fail me. Apollo 1, okay. And apparently that also took place in a January. And so that's where the title comes from. And it is just, the poem will make you cry. So
dealing with spaceships. I tend to not be crazy about the definition of science fiction poetry, including straight science poems without the fictional element, which that one technically is, but it is also technically a spaceship poem. Maybe these are real spaceships, but to me that makes it solidly part of the genre.
Well, here's a question. When you mentioned before that you felt strongly about poetry having the narrative aspect, I'm not 100% well-versed in modern contemporary poetry in the mainstream, but when I'm exposed to it, especially in Conjunctions magazine, it seems like a strong narrative thread is fairly rare even in the mainstream poetry these days. Am I off base on that?
Not at all.
There are actually some magazines that, some literary magazines that specialize in narrative poetry.
Hmm.
And the narrative can be subtle. It can be implied. It doesn't take much with poetry to create the effect of a narrative sometimes. It can happen with an extremely short poem on occasion. And long ones too, of course. But in poetry, even more than fiction, I think it's good to do it in a way that lets the reader make the connections, that there are gaps that the reader can bridge, rather than being led by the nose through the whole thing step by step. But I don't know that narrative is that rare in mainstream poetry, and I don't know that genre work in general is becoming much more common.
A criticism that I have heard of speculative poetry from folks with a predilection for poetry that I guess is not speculative. It's hard to tell if there really is a mainstream poetry. I guess there's definitely poetry that appears in literary publications. Is that speculative poetry is hidebound by narrative? In other words, it's very difficult to create a speculative poem without ending up essentially telling a mini short story. And there are some people who think that poetry is more interesting when it's freed from narrative. Now, you know, that said, I actually think a lot of poetry has some degree of narrative. you can never completely escape it. What Jeannie mentioned at the very end there, something that has been happening over, I don't know, the past 10 years ago or so, I couldn't pinpoint when it started, But because science fiction has become so widespread in popular culture, what you're seeing is poets who do not have any sort of fandom or genre roots making use of the science fiction tropes because they've encountered them in popular culture. And then those end up in Prairie Schooner or Poetry Magazine or what have you. And that's a lot of fun. Of course, for those of us who are, for those of us who are perhaps carrying the torch or think of ourselves as carrying the torch, hey, we're in Asimov's magazine with our poetry. when somebody, somebody publishes something in Poetry Magazine that's, based on an idea that we've seen 1,000 times before, and they end up getting a $100,000 grant for it. We're like, ah! But at the same time, it's cool. And sometimes those folks, Jeanine Hall Gailey would be one example, end up coming and finding us and contributing to Mythic Delirium or to Starline or to websites like Goblin Fruit or Stonetelling or Strange Horizons, because because they're producing more of that kind of work than the Paris Review is willing to take on, and they still want to find somewhere for it. And so that's always fun.
I think it's wonderful when really good poets start to make use of the tropes, and they find that they can sometimes do a lot more with the speculative aspect than they can with the mundane aspects. A couple of years ago, Billy Collins had a very clearly, purely hard science fiction poem in The New Yorker called The Future. It was a wonderful poem, which I don't believe I can legally read without permission, so we can't do that. But it can. But you can Google it. The New Yorker has it available on their website. Just Google "The Future," Billy Collins. It's a marvelous poem, and I know a lot of poets in locally who are very good poets who are not science fiction readers or writers, but gradually more and more of them have been coming over to the dark side to non-speculative poets who are in my writing group have started turning out more and more horror poems. One guy's writing about zombies, Charles Cantrell, who recently had one of them in Strange Horizons, and another of my friends, Jeannie Tomasco, has been writing these extremely peculiar poems about a little girl named Violet, and one of them also recently appeared in Strange Horizons. I think the fact that science fiction publications pride themselves on paying contributors has done a lot to positively reinforce this trend. They were very pleasantly surprised to find that Strange Horizons paid $20 a poem. They're not used to getting paid for publication in the mainstream world at all.
Right.
That is one of the fascinating things about it. I taught at a writers' conference here in Roanoke, Virginia, back in January, and was able to break that news that, guess what? In genre markets, the standard is to pay people. And they were like, wow. but I guess I am not, I mean, I have a master's degree, but I have never been particularly plugged into the academic literary scene. So I don't know how all those dynamics work, but it is true that, most of the majority of those markets just don't pay. And I think people who discover that we do are generally appreciative of it, even though oftentimes of necessity we can't pay all that much.
Right, right.
It's like beer money.
Yeah, or you know, I guess
no beer money.
Would it even pay for a happy meal anymore? I'm not sure. Well, you know, Rose Lemberg, who is a relatively new poet, who she runs the poetry website Stone Telling, which is a very interesting site in itself. It is a speculative poetry zine that is dedicated to addressing issues of diversity, queer issues. I think her most recent issue was The Queer Issue, in which she specifically asked for poetry that addressed that sort of topic. But Rose, on her own blog, did a wonderful little post that I thought was kind of a perfect description of the speculative poetry community, because she worked from an old adage. I hope she'll forgive me if she listens to this, because I'm not going to remember this quite right, but the idea of somebody having a penny and buying food from someone, and then the person with the penny then, you know, has to get food by giving the penny back to the first person, and eventually they have no food. Well, she took that analogy and kind of turned it on its head and kind of said, well, okay, suppose we all have one penny, but we each create art in exchange for the penny. You know, eventually at the end we still only have the one penny, but we've generated all this wonderful art passing it around back and forth. And that's a pretty good analogy. That's a pretty good analogy for the purpose served by the typical $5 poetry payment. You know, because a lot of us who write this are also editors. We end up buying work from each other, but it's good work, and lots of neat stuff ends up getting created because of it. So I felt the need to share that as kind of a wonderful portrait of how things can work in our corner. Next time.
I would like to see poetry become more respectable and more lavishly paid, for sure. One thing that exists in the poetry world, and I think this is unfortunately true across the genre mainstream barrier, is that the writers themselves are expected to support the genre by being fans and consumers. I don't think we see that quite so much in fiction. I think there's more division between the people who are doing the creative work and the people who are consuming that work and reading it. You have writers and you have fans, and it's rare that fiction writers are guilt-tripped by publishers into purchasing their own work or the publications in which their work appears.
Now, I don't guilt trip you that badly.
not you, but
not you, Mike.
but you know what I mean. There's if you do any amount of submitting poetry, this is really common. They send out. In fact, that I've even received requests for donations, not even subscriptions, but just flat out donations from presses that I had submitted to, which I kind of resent. I mean, I feel like the marketing should be the that if you're going to produce a journal, you should have some marketing skills before you start doing that. Now, Mike, I don't think you have a problem there, and this doesn't apply to mythical lyria. But it's often neglected. I know with Starline, up until I began editing it, there was no subscription option. The only way you could get it was, you could buy a single copy, or you could join SFPA, but there was no provision for people who might be fans of science fiction poetry that were not poets themselves, which I thought was really crazy. It was as if they were not acknowledging that anyone who liked science fiction poetry existed.
Well,
I think that's very sad. And this is a problem with the entire poetry community, not just genre, but that it's not marketed, that all of it seems to be below the radar.
Well, now, I have a number of opinions on this, and I mean, part of it is, I think, poetry has unfortunately evolved such that the largest audience for it right now are the people who want to be poets. I have no doubt that there are exceptions to that, but I think that that has actually become more the rule. And you're right, it's not just speculative poetry, it's poetry all over. I recall several years ago there was some article that disclosed that Poetry Magazine, which I guess is the creme de la creme, you know, they're the ones who have the multi-million-dollar foundation behind them. You know, they get something. They got like on an order of magnitude more of submissions than they actually had subscribers. That is probably true. You know, that is probably true across the board. And people who write short stories should take heed, because short stories are definitely headed in that same direction. You know, I guess
that's
novels.
My understanding.
Hmm?
That's my understanding, that short story venues can sometimes have that same problem.
Right. And you know, and I guess it's just a matter of how tastes have evolved. You know, novels obviously, still seem to have a genuine audience that is not just composed of hopefuls who want to publish novels themselves. Although, you know, I guess given you know, the sort of flood to self-publish that has occurred now that we have the rise of Amazon Kindle, I wonder how much that's true as well. But you know, what I was going to say is there's just no easy way to fix that. I mean, even as a group, we speculative poets, working to kind of stem that tide. I mean, we're just kind of like a twig in a river. So what we have to do, as I see it, is just make sure that what we're doing is interesting and visible, and you know, and go from there.
I hope that what will happen with poetry and perhaps short stories will be, especially with the growing presence of e-books and literature, is something more like the Pandora model, where people will have increasing access to things that they didn't know existed and would never have encountered in the normal flow of events.
But you have to
create a presence. You have to make the poetry and of course the stories accessible, so people can pick them up on the spur of the moment, encounter them easily. One of the nice things about Starline is it's not only inexpensive per issue. Right now it's $5 an issue, but it's much less than that for a PDF, which also never used to be an option. And the PDF subscription is really very reasonable. And I think that the slam poetry is something that's been marginalized too for a long time, but it has become more and more popular, more and more in the public eye. And the guys, the poets, male and female, I should say, who are doing slam tend to tour and read a lot of venues all over the country, and they produce their own chapbooks, their own CDs, and sell them at the venues and do quite well. And even slam has its own little subcategory of SFNL poetry, sure. Because every year at Nationals, there is the Nerd Slam, where you have to actually demonstrate expertise in some area of geekdom to qualify.
Well, that's
something like Star Wars or the writings of Terry Pratchett or Neil Gaiman, and it's really pretty wonderful.
I've participated in poetry slams, and I'm one of those. It just so happens to work this way. A lot of my own poems work like monologues, so I've done a fair amount of reading, and it can be a lot of fun. There's a big gap, I guess, between the kind of poetry that works as slam poetry and the kind of poetry that, for example, you might see published in Asimov's. It'd be wonderful to see that bridge somehow. I don't know how to do it, but it'd be great if it happened. This has nothing much to do with what Jeannie just said, but I feel the need to just mention that one of my Risling Award-winning poems, which is called The Strip Search, was actually written first as a performance poem. And, you know, I'm very pleased that it wound up doing as well as it did. But, you know, I guess that had... There's a difference between poetry for performance and poetry for the page, or there can be, and that difference is sometimes when you're writing from the page, when you're writing for the page, what you create is counting on the reader to be able to kind of sit back and meditate on what you've created and pick up on the references you're making. The performance poetry has got to be sort of immediately connecting with your audience, because you're not going to win that slam if you're confusing them. but it can be done. Jeannie, something I realize that we have not done, and Karen, I hope you don't mind indulging me.
Hmm?
We ought to talk about why on earth we do this. How do we get into it, even to begin with?
Oh, yes, that'd be very interesting.
And let me, I'm going to kick it to you first.
Jeez, that's kind of an amazing question. I wrote a little bit of poetry in high school at the beginning of college. I didn't write anymore for 20, 25 years, but I read a lot of science fiction, and I got invited by a group of local artists I knew to start a poetry critique group, and I began writing poetry, and it seemed pretty decent from the get-go. I was satisfied with what I was writing. I got a lot of help from the critique group. I think a good critique group is imperative for success as a writer. You have to be working with people who can offer competent criticism, and not just make you feel good about your work either. That's the kiss of death.
Yeah,
sure.
And I started going to open mics and slams. I started sending out for publication maybe a couple of years later. And I started getting published and winning contests and just kept going from there.
Okay.
And because I've always been such a fan of science fiction and fantasy, it was inevitable that it would enter my work as a poet.
That makes sense. Well, my story of how I became a science fiction poet is kind of odd, but that's pretty much true of everything about me. You know, I grew up, or at least I spent most of my formative years in this little coal mining town in far southwest Virginia. And so I was very isolated. I wasn't part of any fandom scene or what have you. But, you know, because my parents had interest in science fiction, my dad was a big fan of The Lord of the Rings, I was introduced to that stuff at a pretty young age. And then I was sort of on my own to try and figure out how to get hold of more of it. And so I went in all sorts of weird directions. I actually went so far as to like start reading critical essays on Tolkien. That's how bad I had it. And these essays drew connections with, say, T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. I'm like, oh, if that's like The Lord of the Rings, I'll go read it. And of course, I mean, you know, The Wasteland is like The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, that must have been a bit of a, how do you say, shock.
It was interesting. It was interesting. Certainly, I was not at that young age, you know, able to draw any immediate connection. But I was like, well, you know, this is, you know, I think it was a Colin Wilson essay, and it was actually comparing the two works. And so I was like, well, okay, you know, I guess I'm supposed to like this, so I'm going to figure out how I should like it. And you know, but I did get a lot of cool things out of that. You know, there's all that City of the Dead and the tarot imagery, you know, lots of stuff to kind of, for a young mind to kind of latch around. And I also, you know, read Tolkien's own poetry. Of course, you know, that's a very different thing from what T.S. Eliot was doing. But, you know, I came out with this idea that, you know, it's all of a piece. You know, if you're a writer, you write your novel, you write poetry, you know, you do it all. It's, you know, it's all connected. And so, you know, that's how I sort of developed as a creative writer. I was determined to write it all. And I guess when I was a teenager, I had a subscription to Asimov's. And as I've mentioned several times already, you know, Asimov's publishes poetry. You know, they use it, I mean, you know, to be frank, I mean, they kind of use it as filler when they have extra space on a page. But it's still there. They're still doing
nice
it.
Stuff, though. They always illustrate the poem.
Yeah, that's one of the... Nowadays, they don't illustrate the stories anymore, but they illustrate the poems. you know, it's I've been the recipient of that. It's kind of fascinating.
Yes.
Because I, you know, loved science fiction and had this impression that science fiction was just as much about poetry as it was about prose, you know, because of this combination of factors, you know, I actually applied myself. I actually applied myself pretty vigorously to, you know, trying to write poetry. And it was, I guess, when I first started to sell things to small press markets back in 1992. Yes, I'm a dinosaur. you know, it was the poetry that I really started selling first. So I'm like, okay, well, this is what I'm writing that people buy, so I'm gonna just write more of this. And you know, it actually came as a shock to me you know, years into doing this, that people in science fiction were absolutely bewildered that science fiction poetry even existed.
Yeah.
I'm like, but.
It's always been there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it has.
Well, I mean, the reason the Risling Award is called the Risling Award is a Heinlein poem, isn't it?
Right, right. The Green Hills of Earth.
Although he's technically a songwriter rather than a poet.
Yeah.
And I do feel that there is a distinction.
I would agree with that. I mean, I guess, you know, when Suzette Hayden Elgin, who unfortunately I understand is in very bad health now, but when she founded the Science Fiction Poetry Association, I guess she decided that a link to Heinlein would be a good way to call attention to the award, and they apparently agreed to it. And so, you know, the SFPA is basically kind of saddled with this bard, you know, as their patron figure. But, you know, what can you do?
Although, to be fair, the oldest poetry was always meant to be accompanied by musical instruments, even
yeah.
though it was considered poetry rather than song.
Right. Well, I mean, a lot of the oldest poetry is technically speculative poetry. You know,
right. The epic stories and...
Right.
Beowulf.
And, you know, the idea that there's something separate is, I guess, is very much a 20th century idea.
Do you feel that science fiction poetry or speculative poetry, I guess, again, with all poetry in our culture and our times, is sort of swimming upstream against... I know I always felt that I had been taught poetry poorly and so had to overcome that when I started to appreciate it in my, you know, after college.
Sure.
Yes. I think poetry is presented horribly in our school systems in this day and age. And the poetry establishments no longer try to reach out to any consumers. That there used to be a huge public fan base for poetry, but now even people who like poetry, who say they like poetry, you ask them what poets they like, and they'll name, you know, Frost, James Whitcomb Riley, and this is very sad. I think most people would like poetry if they were given a chance to access good poetry. Instead, they're made to feel that it's the sort of thing someone's aunt writes for a wedding or a funeral or the horrible crap that thousands of people turned out immediately after 9/11, for instance. They're only used to seeing occasional poetry produced by people who aren't poets, and it's awful, and it's very sad. I had a couple of poems that were circulating on the internet quite a bit. The people were posting without permission on their blogs, but that's okay. And one of them had been posted somewhere, and someone put in the comments, "Usually I hate poetry, but this Bergman..." And I think to date that's one of the nicest things that anyone has ever said about a poem of mine. And I think it's those people that need to be somehow given the opportunity to read poetry that they don't realize they would enjoy.
Mm.
Well, you know, this is true. You know, this is one of the things about being an advocate for poetry. I mean, if you come up to me, I think I can say this without being arrogant because I've done it enough times. If someone comes up to me and says, "Well, I don't really like poetry, and I think science fiction poetry sounds stupid," which has happened, then you know, I can say, "Well, Give me a little bit of your time. Let me show you a couple things. And usually, you know, that will be all it takes. But, you know, I'm only one person. Jeannie's only one person. And so it is hard to do that. And it is hard to fight, you know, widespread indifference and widespread misconceptions. You know, I'm glad Jeannie mentioned her internet experience because I think, though I would not call it the antidote, it is definitely an essential tool. I mean, certainly for me, I had poems being published in little print, small press zines for years. And, you know, I couldn't have told you if anybody had a clue I existed. But when my stuff started appearing online in Strange Horizons, you know, all of the sudden, you know, I had a little bitty audience. And I think the internet certainly has the effect of bringing poets and poetry lovers together in a way that has not happened before. You know, the more of that we can do, more power to it. I don't know what it would take to get to the Pandora model that Jeannie was talking about.
I have to admit, that Pandora model does sound fascinating. I've used Pandora for music myself, and I have tripped across some amazing artists that I never would have encountered otherwise.
Oh, sure. Yes. You know, I guess somebody would have to create it.
Create it and get the rights to it. Oh, my Lord, I can't imagine. If you think anthologies are hard.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've poetry anthologies are nothing to sneeze at, I can tell you. But it'd be a wonderful idea if it could work.
Although, on that sort of note, probably a good way to wrap this up might be if you could both chime in with a few... We've mentioned a few scattered examples of where you would look, where you would direct people right now to find some of the best that's going on in SF poetry.
Jeannie, do you want to go first?
Well, you've mentioned, of course, Starline and at Strange Horizons, Mythic Delirium, Asimov's occasionally analog, Dreams and Nightmares, Nightblade. Horrible feeling I'm going to forget someone important. Apex, Weird Tales, Abyss and Apex, where I'm also an editor. A Canadian journal on spec. Kaizine. Actually, the markets page on the sfpoetry.com site, the Science Fiction Poetry Association's own website, has a huge list of places that are publishing science fiction poetry. Big Pulp, Silver Blade. Mike, would you like to continue?
I'm going to repeat a couple of the same ones you mentioned, but there's really a wide range of these things that exist right now. You have, say, for example, Dreams and Nightmares, or the Magazine of Speculative Poetry, and these are little do-it-yourself print zines that have existed for about, you know, what, 20-some, 25 years at least, where you have a dedicated editor like Roger Dutcher or David C. Kapaska-Merkle, who are just, you know, out of love of doing it, putting these things out. You know, Starline, that Jeannie now edits, is a print zine that has been around for that long, although that has the
Goblin Fruit again.
Right. Goblin Fruit, on the other end, you have these relatively new and dynamic websites. Goblin Fruit, I mentioned Amal El-Motar and her partner Jessica Wick. They founded that in 2006. Because they weren't seeing enough of the myth-based and fantasy-based poetry that they liked in the markets that existed already. And that site, goblinfruit.net, has gone on to have a huge following, at least in poetry standards. I mentioned Stone Telling. you know, by Rose Lemberg. There's a new site called Ink Scrawl. It's put out by Rose's publishing company. But you know, it's an online site and it's devoted to poems 10 lines or less. Samantha Henderson edits that.
Illumen.
Yes, Illumen, and there's a number of zines published by Sam's Dot Publications, run by Tyree Campbell. I think he also does Sci-Fi Quest, which is another. Excuse me. No, that's right. Sci-Fi Quest, which is devoted to Sci-Fi Coup, which is the science fiction themed haiku.
Space and time.
Right. Although.
And speaking of space, Astropoetica, which specializes in astronomy related poetry.
Hmm.
So,
Bullspec.
Idiomancer. In the science fiction poetry world, you basically sort of have, you have some zines like Mythic Delirium that I put out, or Starline, that are pretty much completely devoted to poetry. And those are usually pretty small. But then a lot of the major markets also include poetry. And so the poetry is right there. To read the reviews that get published of speculative publications, you'd think it's not there. For some reviewers are scared of reviewing poems. I don't know why. But there are a few reviewers that will also tackle the poetry, like Terry Wayna, I think you pronounce her name, at Fantasy Literature. So, you know, thank goodness for them. It might actually be harder to kind of, you know, say where you can't find it. Come to think of
that,
it.
Those are some pretty exhaustive lists right there.
Yeah. And we could go on.
Okay, but I think that's probably a good place to wrap this up. I want to thank you both for coming on.
Sure.
I think this will make a great sort of kickoff to Locus's run on science fiction poetry.
Well, thank you.
We're so glad that you chose to do this. I'm really very grateful for the chance to spread the light.
Indeed. So thank you both very much, and hopefully we will talk again.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.